Let's begin Psalm 32. Count yourself lucky. How happy you must be. You get a fresh start. Your slate's wiped clean. Count yourself lucky. God holds nothing against you. And you're holding nothing back. When I kept it all inside, my bones turned to powder. My words became day-long groans. The pressure never let up. All the juices of my life dried up. Then I let it all out. I said, I'll make a clean breast of my failures to God, and suddenly the pressure was gone. My guilt dissolved. My sin disappeared. These things add up. Every one of us needs to pray. When all hell breaks loose and the dam bursts, we'll be on high ground, untouched. You are forgiven. What a blessing that is. It's a done deal. What a blessing that is. A fresh start is always yours to have. When I allowed my stuff to stay within me unexamined, my bones grew old, my vitality was sapped, there was groaning in my soul all day and dissipation of divine life within me all night. But when I faced my stuff, when I looked fearlessly at it, what a blessing that was. My spirit was freed from self-deceit. And now, come hell or high water, I'm standing on solid ground. We finish our lesson today on confession, these 5 weeks that we have had together looking at this application in everyday life of the ancient virtue of humility. And in this lesson, we have spoken about the context for confession. We've talked about the courage demanded in order to walk into this, having become unfamiliar territory. We've talked about where that courage comes from. We talked about creating the environment in which we can act as a confession receiver, confessor, we called it. We've talked about taking confession back from the reduced place that it has been stuck of being put into religious ritual or put into therapeutic counseling and reintegrating it back into spiritual community. We've talked about recreating the environment of spiritual community for the purpose of having this kind of life freedom be part of our everyday lives. And so today we come to the conclusion of the lesson and we talk about actually making a confession. So I want to get right to it. Making a confession is about self-awareness. It is not about forgiveness. We do not have to gain God's forgiveness. God's forgiveness is a constant. God's forgiveness is embedded in the very nature of the divine, and the Spirit of God lives within you. All the forgiveness you ever need, or all the forgiveness you're ever going to have, is already within you. That's not a question that needs to be solved. But, as the text said, when I did this thing, when I made a clean breast of things, when I saw what I hadn't seen, when I looked at what I hadn't been looking at, I was able to live in the lightness of that forgiveness. Because though all the forgiveness we ever need or ever are going to have is already within us, we don't always access what is there. And so confession becomes an act of accessing divine forgiveness that is always within us. So, as a result, it begins with interior work. It begins by looking inside. Before we say a word to anybody about anything, we look inside ourselves. And so I'm going to lay out six steps that I use in my own life in terms of how I have learned confession over these years, and I will share them with you. The first step is to ask for help. I make a prayer when I begin my times of interior reflection, and the prayer is for eyes that see and ears that hear. A prayer of courage to make a fearless moral inventory. It's a prayer of desire. I want to see what some part of me wants to keep me from seeing. There's some part of me that doesn't want me to look at my darkness, and it's always working. There's some part of me that wants to keep me distracted. There's some part of me that wants to keep me from looking at those things that will poke at my existential shame, and that's always functioning and always working. And so I ask for help. And it has been my experience, by simply articulating that prayer, articulating that desire before the indwelling presence of God, before the Holy Spirit that is within me, that this simple act goes a long way to helping me move forward. It opens my eyes more than they were opened. It heightens my alertness more than it was heightened. It precipitates a sense of watchfulness, a sense of awakening, the kind of prayer of saying, "Give me eyes to see," changes something of my posture in the interior world. And so I begin with a prayer. I ask for help. The second thing that I've learned to do over the years is to keep a list of words handy to help me reflect. And the list of words is things that I have picked up through the years that help me hold up a plumb line to my life and ask how I'm doing. A good list is what Michael sang earlier, the fruit of the Spirit from Galatians 5. I have a list there that talks about love and joy and kindness and goodness and self-control. And I think about that word and I ask, how am I doing? How am I doing with kindness? And I think about my days and I hold that word up against my days. How am I doing with peace? Have I been anxious or have I been peaceful? And I use that as a template for helping me think about my life. Another list of words that I have, that I keep, is the seven heavenly virtues. If you don't know what those are, go Google them. But I'll tell you what they are. You take the seven deadly sins and you look at their opposites, and that's the seven heavenly virtues. I also have the list of the seven deadly sins: envy and anger, wrath, and those attributes that are associated with pride and gluttony and lust. And I hold these words there, and I think, here are these words, here is my life, how I'm doing, how am I doing? And part of that prayer is to say, Spirit of God within me, on this issue of wrath, on this issue of sloth, how am I doing? On this issue of self-control, on this issue of goodness, how am I doing? How have the last few weeks gone in terms of temperance? By the way, that's another good list to have, is the four cardinal virtues: temperance, justice, fortitude, prudence. How am I doing in regard to these things? And I hold these up and I say, here are the words, here is my life, what's going on? The third step is I begin to make a list of the things that I see. In the process of thinking through those words, perhaps comes to my mind a person that I resent. Maybe a time when I felt guilty. Or if you do this, you might find a time when you were afraid, or a time that you were critical, and you jot that down. Who was it? When did it happen? What was going on? This unspoken conflict that really is going on between me and that coworker, I know that thing's happening, and I just haven't been thinking about it. I write it down. Negative feelings that I have toward my boss, stresses and worries that I have over my finances, being hopping mad at that most intimate person in my life that I love more than anything, but I just want to strangle her. A list of those things that have been painful in our days. You know, we have this expression we say all the time, that afflictive emotions are your friend, because afflictive emotions reveal something that's going on inside, something that we've been keeping hidden from ourselves, a coping strategy that has been crossed. And I begin to think through and just jot down what I'm coming to. Perhaps I go another layer deeper, as we'll do in the next step, asking myself, why? Why am I so angry? Why am I so sad? Why am I afraid? What's driving my painful emotion. So we make a prayer for eyes that see. We have some words to help us think. We start a bullet point list. And the next one I should have probably rephrased. Instead of write things down, I should have written down, expand your thoughts on paper. That might have been a better way of saying, expand your thoughts on paper. Because as we come to writing, writing allows us to do something that sometimes flitting thoughts don't allow us to do. It brings some structure to my thoughts and to my feelings. When I write things down, it forces my mind into focus mode. Random thoughts that are flitting through my head sometimes lack the structure, lack the discipline to be able to go as deeply as I can do when I write them down. So in effect, what I'm doing is I'm beginning a process of digging into my self-awareness. So what we're going to learn in this conflict resolution process over the summer is we're going to learn about how to dig into the interior life, because so much of what happens in conflicts between people is working for justice. When you're having a conflict with somebody, odds are you're trying to get fairness. You're trying to get equity. You're trying to get justice. And if there's 100 units, you probably get those. You get 85 of those worked out just fine that way. But the ones that doesn't work aren't going to work, because you've been trying and trying to get fairness. You've been trying to get justice. You need another approach, a very different approach, and that's what we're going to talk about this summer. But part of that different approach is coming to understand. What I'm doing is I'm digging into understanding what's going on inside of me. So I'm asking myself a different set of questions. The first that I ask is, what does that mean? I did this thing. I said that word. I had this thought. I had this emotion. I had this afflictive process going on. It's going on, but what does it mean? What does it mean when this person does that and I respond this way? Why is that a problem? What's going on inside of me that says, I'm afraid, I'm hurt? Why am I hurt? Why am I afraid? And then we go underneath the meaning that we assign to this action. We begin to ask about our feelings. And see, feelings are important indicators. They're a great litmus test, because feelings are something that we experience in our bodies. There is a physical sensation associated with betrayal, that emotion of being betrayed. There is a physical sensation associated with feeling condemned. There is a physical sensation that we feel in our stomach, or we feel in our chest, or we feel it in our neck, or we feel in our jaw, that's associated with feeling uncherished. And our body will indicate this response. And our bodies don't lie to us. However, that's some really difficult stuff to process, so what we tend to do is push it down, and we deal with just the final upheaval, which is usually masked as anger or anxiety, one of the big ones, one of the masking emotions. And so we don't get used to asking ourselves about our physical sensations, and we get really bad at reading our physical sensations. We have a hard time. If someone asks us what betrayal feels like, many times we don't know what betrayal feels like. How does that feel? What does happen in my body? What does happen in my head and my eyes and my neck and my chest? What happens when I feel betrayed? But what we do when we're taking this inventory is we ask ourselves that question, and we write down, what did I feel? What is my body telling me? There is a way that my body feels when I am discouraged. There is a way that my body feels when I am overwhelmed. And so we take time to listen and we say, what's going on down there? What's my body telling me that's going on down there? And if we will take the time to listen, there are important cues. And those important cues will lead us, as we continue this exercise in looking and listening within, to what is happening to us, that will lead us even deeper. Now, notice again, we haven't said a word to anybody about anything yet. Because underneath those feelings, there are some false self-beliefs. My body is telling me what I feel, but those feelings will indicate what I believe. And usually clustered around a deep sense of fear, usually clustered around some interior sense of shame, or clustered around a homemade identity, something I have made for myself. I am the competent one, and now I'm having an afflictive emotion because I am feeling incompetent. I am the liked one, and now I'm having this afflictive emotion and these actions and reactions because she doesn't like me. I am the good-looking one, but as I'm aging, I'm realizing that my looks are fading. I am the successful one, but this enterprise has gone wrong, and I'm not being successful. And we look at these instincts, these X, Y, Z coping strategies that we have made for ourselves, and we ask ourselves, what does that indicate that I believe about me? And is it working? Is it true? And if it isn't working, how am I reacting? And oh, that. And what I'm doing is I'm writing all this stuff down. I am jotting these things down so that they don't escape me. And just a technological side note, if you do not yet have access to the cloud, get it. Because when you write it down somewhere, you want to have it with you. So if you don't have Dropbox, get Dropbox and create a file for your reflections, because then you'll have Dropbox on your computer and on your other computer and on your phone, and you will have access to this wherever you need it. So we make a prayer for eyes that see. We have some words handy to help us reflect. We start a bullet point list. We start asking some probing questions and writing down what we see there. And then fifth, finally, now we begin to talk about what we have seen with our spiritual friend. And here's the value of having written this down, because all we do is bring along our list, bring along our ideas, and we begin to talk about them together. And the reason for this is odds are this time of self-reflection, you're going to find space and time for it in your life on a Thursday. And it's going to be a Sunday afternoon before you finally get a chance to get together with a spiritual friend and chat about it. And if your brain is like my brain, from the time you get to Thursday, from Thursday to Sunday, everything that you thought about on Thursday is gone. So you need to have it on paper. So then you come and you simply read to your spiritual friend and you say, here's what I'm seeing. And with as much unvarnished honesty as possible, you tell them, here's what's going on inside of me, here's what I have seen thus far, and here's what I might not be seeing, and my suspicion is that this might be going on as well, and here's what I regret, and here's what I yearn for, and here's what I think I missed. Now, it's so important to remember what we said last week, that prerequisite to this step is creating an environment for ourselves, people who I trust and people who trust me. People with whom I share camaraderie and confidentiality. Because failure to create that kind of network of spiritual friendships is why confession has not been normalized in our communities. And why it has fallen on such hard times is because it's a very difficult thing to do absent trust and trustworthiness. When the church went through the Reformation about 500 years ago, we adapted our story to fit into the emerging modern worldview, into the Enlightenment worldview, and in so doing, we made a little bit of a deal with the devil. And that is, in adapting our religion to modern sensibilities, to Western sensibilities, we made our religion a little bit of an individualistic religion, because we live in a Western individualistic society. And so now, after all these years, some areas of our religion are practiced almost exclusively alone, in private. Consequently, dealing with the dark side of our lives has become a very private affair, something that we do before God and do before God alone. Perhaps we do it in private prayer, maybe in a few moments before communion. But the idea of talking about our darkness with a real, live, flesh and blood human being sharing the journey with us, well, this practice has pretty much died out. And this deal with the devil has left us with a couple of options. One is to soldier on, absent this life-awakening practice, functioning in the blindness that happens when we don't come into self-awareness. And the other option is to pay somebody to act as a confessor. And as valuable as that has been in my own life, I hope in yours, this lesson isn't about taking confession to the ritualized, institutionalized place. It's about restoring confession into everyday, normal, spiritual community and making these kinds of conversations normative in our lives. I read somewhere a quote from Carl Jung. I looked for it. I couldn't find it again to quote to you, but I had it in my notes, where he said that therapy arose out of a void in Christian community. Making a fearless moral inventory normal. A fearless quest into looking at our dark sides. Making it safe and natural, and these conversations normal. This is our heritage. It's ours to have. This is how we are to live together. Now, yes, it does go cross-grained to Western instincts, but it is worth it to go cross-grains to Western instincts when that is misleading us. And so my hope is that over these weeks, this lesson has piqued enough interest that you might consider revisiting those instincts that informs so much of how we live, and that you would make a prayer for eyes to see, that you would have some words that are handy to help you reflect, that you would start some bullet points of the things that you see and then expand that by digging more deeply, and then that you would talk about them, the things you see, with a spiritual friend. And finally, I just want to tell you something that has worked in my own life, and that is permission giving. Last week, we talked about how the one who receives the confession, the confessor, does not fix the one who gives the confession, the confessee, does not solve his or her problem, but rather is simply present in the same way that a midwife is present at a birth, because a growth moment is being born, and the confessor encourages and affirms and shares life, but doesn't fix. Now, the therapeutic sciences and the recovery groups have really picked up on this because it's such an important feature of making things safe, knowing that I can make my confession without an undercurrent of judgment. This is critical. But that being said, in spiritual community, sometimes we want another person's perspective. We want to know what their eyes see. Remember, I've used the metaphor of our eyes. My eyes don't see my eyes see you. You, however, use your eyes to see me. So consequently, I have a better perspective on you than I have on my own interior world, because in my own interior world, this is the air that I breathe, this is the water that I drink, it's just so normalized, this is what I do. And it might be crazy, but it's become normal to me inside of this reality, and I need a perspective from outside of myself to look at me. But this gets tricky, because on the one hand, I want perspective. But on the other hand, I don't want someone jumping in to fix me. So we have a mixed message going on inside of ourselves, and so we project a mixed message to one another. And this is one of those sticky balance points in life, because jumping in to fix and solve and heal, too hot. Never giving a perspective, too cold. And sometimes giving perspective, sometimes not giving perspective, and being able to discern just the right moment in which to do which, just right. Not too hot, not too cold, just right. And so how many of us are really good at being able to discern that just right point all the time? None of us. We get it wrong. That's part of this thing. So what do we do facing that dilemma? Well, what we can do is we can give one another limited permission to get it wrong. We can give one another limited permission to get it wrong. I've had all my life, and I continue to have friends to whom I have given permission to call me out. And sometimes those call outs are off base. Sometimes what they say to me has more to do with their experience of life, their perception of life, and that bleeds into their conversation with me, and they make judgments of me that have more to do with their own life than they have to do with mine. And when they are wrong, and when they misjudge me, or when they talk about me in ways that are not accurate, I don't like it. Not one little bit. I feel judged, I feel misunderstood, and it is a tough pill to swallow. But when it happens in my life, I have done this on all but one occasion. I have gone out of my way even when their words are telling me things that don't resonate with me, and even when I tell them that their words don't resonate with me, I go out of my way to emphasize how glad I am that they have ventured out, because I never, never, never want them to abandon this that I've come to believe is a sacred duty. The few times that they have caused me unnecessary pain are nothing, nothing, nothing compared to the pain that they have saved me when they help me see something that is toxic and hidden in my soul. It doesn't make it easy to tolerate the times they get it wrong, but it does make it good. Now, I will say this about that your spiritual friends have a built-in incentive not to talk to you about something that they see. They have a built-in incentive to avoid that, because there's a couple of features that go on in our lives. First, we are all doing our best, subtly, unconsciously, to create an environment that keeps people from talking about our stuff, because we're doing our best not to even see our stuff. So that, you got to know, is just going on. The second thing is, they are your friends. And friends, by nature, want to be friendly. And so consequently, they have affection for us, and they don't want to say something that might hurt us. They don't want to say something that might offend us. And so, though you need their eyes looking and seeing within yourself, there's a built-in resistance for that to happen. It's going to be very difficult for them to take this role in your life unless you give them a little bit of permission, a little bit of permission to give you they got it wrong pain. We won't get the immense benefit of the times people get it right in our lives unless we give them permission to sometimes get it wrong. Now, it's important to note that I'm talking to the confession maker, not the confession receiver, because this is you, this is your life, this is your confession, this is your interior world, and this is your need to see. And so, consequently, you get the right to decide who gets this role in your life. Nobody gets to invite themselves into this role. You get to extend the right for that role. And so, it's not a role for everybody. If somebody has just a terrible hit rate, they call you out all the time and they never get it right, don't invite them. If someone has not earned your trust, don't invite them. If someone has not earned your affection, don't invite them. If someone betrays a trust, don't invite them. But if you can find someone that you trust, and if you are blessed to find someone that you know is on your side, someone you know loves you and someone who has just even some capacity to discern, then I would suggest on my own life experience that it's worth the risk. It's worth the risk to invite and to intentionally give permission, and on balance, the pain that will be caused when they get it right compared to the pain that you save when they don't get it right, the pain that you save when they do, it makes it worth it. So, I hope that you will consider this ancient practice. I hope that you will consider creating for yourself a network of trusted spiritual friends. I hope that you will consider taking some time to look within and to focus on self-awareness. I hope that it will become a regular practice of your life to make this fearless inventory, to move into that dimension of self-awareness. And I hope that you will muster the courage to step out and to share with a spiritual friend what the darkness that you find looks like. And that you will experience the freedom and life that this ancient practice has afforded our tradition for centuries. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a minister in Nazi Germany, and he was part of the German resistance, and he saw it as his Christian duty to oppose Nazism, even to the point that he participated in a plot to assassinate Hitler. And his spiritual writings were ahead of their time. He was doing a great deal of rethinking the Christian story, even in the 30s and the 40s. And a lot of the way that we are rethinking our Christian story now, this 50 years later, can be traced back to some of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's writings. He was a wise man, And he died hung in a concentration camp just days before the end of the war. He died before his time. Listen to what he has to say about confession, a man worthy of our attention. Now then, they didn't use gender-inclusive language, so imagine man or woman. He says, a man who confesses his sins in the presence of a brother knows that he is no longer alone with himself. He experiences the presence of God in the reality of the other person. As long as I am by myself in the confession of my sins, everything remains in the dark. But in the presence of another, darkness has been brought into the light. And my hope for us as a community is that the joy and the lightness and the freedom that are part of this practice will become your experience, our experience. So, Lord, for courage and for spiritual community, and for self-awareness, for these we pray. Be it so among us, in Jesus' name. Amen.